I think at a deeper level, to understand what we mean when we say listening is sacred, I don't think you can do that if you do not feel like you have a God who has listened to you and that you've also listened to. So I think those two things are hand in hand.
Welcome back to Religion to Reality. I'm your host, Dave Plisky. Last week, we heard from a Catholic about what the mode of synodality means for a church who is trying to adopt a posture of listening. This week, we hear from a Protestant about the sociology of listening in a religious context. We are here in the studio. I'm always joined by my friend and co-host, John Gerberowicz, and also our friend and our guest today, Josh Packard, the founder of Future in Faith. Hi, Josh. Welcome to the show.
Hey, it's really great to be back.
And then back you are. You not only were in our first season of the podcast, you also were a guest on our webinar series that actually kicked off Religious Reality before that. So you are the through line. You are the only guest who has appeared on all three. And I really appreciate you being here for us.
I feel like I should get some, like, we should have like a race to see if anybody can match it. Like, I can hold the title until somebody unseats me.
That's a very a generous look at the future of this podcast.
Yeah, I think you're unmatched. You're the New England Patriots of this podcast. So,
but yeah, so, you know, the thrust of this season, as you know, is for us to take what we heard in season one and make something of it here in season two. What we heard was over and over how important listening is. In fact, I'll call it out again, as I did last time you were on the show. I just love the blackboard behind you, or I guess the dry erase board behind you, that has a big sign at the top: listening is sacred. And that is exactly, you know, the message that we were receiving. And we said, okay, if listening is so sacred, well, let us do a bit of listening as we are called to do in our synodal church, you know, and hear what others have to say to speak into us as Catholics. What does the Catholic Church need to hear from others outside the church, or outside the Catholic Church, I should say. And I know you are not a Catholic, but you are very aware of what's going on, I think, in and outside of the Catholic Church and just churches in general. It's part of what you do. But do you want to just remind our listeners, you know, a little bit of your background, especially, you know, I know you come from Springtide Institute, if you want to talk about other things, and just bring us up to speed with everything about who you are.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. It has been one of the greatest sort of pleasures and honors of my career to be able to, I think, credibly cross boundaries and be in front of audiences in lots of different spaces, including Catholic and non-Catholic audiences, even though I'm not Catholic. And it's always been, you know, I try to be really upfront about that, because I know sometimes people want to know, you know, where the speaker is coming from. And so I've been really grateful to be able to be sort of taken seriously and to be, you know, to get to work with a lot of different folks. I was a professor, a sociology professor of religion for about a decade or so, a couple of academic stops, left to be the co-founder of Springtide Research Institute, worked for a little bit of time after that at the National Catholic Educational Association as the director of strategy or something like that. And then, but really I wanted to get back into this like sort of multimodal research driven expression. And that's what led to founding Future of Faith. And at Future of Faith, we're really taking seriously this data that, you know, we've uncovered, but plus lots of other places are telling the same story about the lack of trust in institutions and institutional leaders. And simultaneously, the only thing that people seem to trust right now is relationships. And so we've taken that very head on and thought, like, well, what can we do? Can we play our part, at least, to help the church be more relational, to do so at scale critically? I mean, there's still, you know, church, you can't be it's hard to be relational with hundreds or thousands of people in a parish or in a school or what have you. So we wanted to help, you know, provide some semblance of a solution to that, but also some research around, you know, why it's so critical to listen. And I think, to my knowledge, we have the only research in the world about the intersection of faith formation and listening that shows really that when you sit and listen to somebody, you are actually doing something critical for their faith. It's not just a bridge to get to then tell them something, that there's actually really meaningful stuff happening formatively in that moment. And so that's what sort of brings us to this point, and all of which is really, you know, right in line with this the broader Catholic Church move around synodality, and we've been pleased to be a part of many of those discussions.
I love it. Yeah, you mentioned something really that's been on my heart, you know, especially as we have this one to many, you know, format, which is a podcast, where we're talking about, you know, the scale and how important like listening is, especially in those one-on-one relationships. Romano Guardini was one who, you know, 100 years ago was basically saying like, look, like the more people your message is the medium is designed to reach that your message is contained in, the less impact it's going to have on each one of them, that you're basically diluting it the more, you know, and that makes sense, right? Like imagine having a face-to-face conversation with someone is so immediate and direct and unmediated compared to, you know, the next layer down, whatever that might be today, a group text or phone call or whatever. And, you know, and even right now, you know, the three of us, you know, speaking over Zoom and recording this is one layer. And then we have, so how do you think about like, is there still it seems like there still is a place for this. We need to have these types of conversations, but also, you know, how do you fit that? How do you think about that together?
Yeah. So let me, okay. I mean, I'm not the kind of researcher who typically like, you know, talks data all the time, but I will lead with the data point here. So in our sacred listening study, we asked people, you know, how important were sermons in the moments that mattered most in shaping your faith? And we asked listening and we asked a whole bunch of things. A little over a third of people said that sermons were really important. A little over two thirds said that listening was really important. But nobody should think of this as a false dichotomy. It's not like we have to pick one or the other. It's that, well, cool, sermons work for a third of people. We should keep doing sermons. Anything that's that effective with that group, you know, that size of a group, we should lean into. But we should also recognize that that's just one mode of doing things, and that we might do well then to pay some attention. And I would argue that historically the church, not the Catholic Church, but the broader church, has done essentially nothing in terms of ministries of listening. And that we should do something if two thirds of people are telling us that those are really effective. So you ask me, what's the role of these things? And I'd say both are really necessary. I mean, I'm using sermons here as a stand in for this like one to many kind of communication style. And I think that they're still really effective. I mean, I do understand the irony though. I give a lot of keynotes to a lot of different groups, and I always acknowledge, like, I understand that it's ironic that I'm going to give you a keynote about listening. it's weird, but there are some messages that fit a particular modality, and those messages should be delivered in that way. And so some of those are really good for sermons. So this idea of like making sense of the broader world and giving people a frame through which to interpret current events or, you know, big life moments. Sermons are great for that. One to many kinds of communication is great for that. But if really what you're trying to do is to get somebody to have an experience of the divine or to understand intimately how God is, you know, in touch with their lives and how they might be able to turn to God, that's not likely to happen in a broadcast. Like, we're not going to do that on this podcast, I don't think. You know, but I can do that over a text message with friends. Friends have done that for me, you know, and pastors have sat down with me and done that in spiritual direction. That's why we've always had, you know, all of these kinds of avenues open to us.
Yeah.
You know, it just makes me think as you're saying this, like, you know, the most, let's just say, impactful sermons, homilies that I probably could give or have given are the ones where I feel like the feedback is like, you know, I feel like you were really listening to me, or that you kind of know where I am, you know? So I feel like there is a complete correlation to this, that the most effective type of preaching is one where one has felt like they've been listened to, maybe not personally, of course, but like in a sense where it's like, oh, this person who's preaching to me really understands exactly where I am. And maybe not perfectly, but close enough to know that the preacher is journeying with people. And that, like, another comment I'll get is like, sometimes when I preach something that's, I guess, impactful, is like someone will say, you just seem to be so normal. And like, I'm thinking, I cannot believe that is like the high compliment here, but it, but it's really says a lot, because it says like, oh, you seem like you are one of us. And I think that is really important if we're talking about listening, because to me, what you're really listening to is people's struggles, people's suffering, and just listening and being present to that. And that is common humanity at that point.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that shows you, I think, something really important, John, about the the like where people like the burden of proof is on clergy to prove that they are in touch with their own humanity and yours. It's not the default assumption. And if it ever was, and I'm not sure it ever was, but I mean, more so now than ever, where fewer people have personal experiences with the church than they used to. And the dominant public image of clergy, broadly speaking, is not great. I mean, trust levels for clergy are at all-time lows. And so it's like, I think it's a mindset shift, which can be really hard, I think, if you got into that role, because like people who become clergy, you know, it's a calling, but also there's something attractional about it. And you get into this, and then it's like you got into it not because you distrusted clergy, like you got into it for the other reason. And now to be distrusted is, I don't know, it's hard. And so you're right. Like you do kind of have to then go the other way and like not overcompensate, but make sure you lead with this really human approach.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point you say there, Josh, because actually when I eventually decided to become a priest and enter the seminary, I had two goes at it. I went, left the seminary, went back. I cannot say that I became a priest because I really trusted priests, to the truth. I did not have like this really great experience with priests in general. I mean, clearly there were certain remarkable priests, but I really understood them more as being friends in some ways rather than just the office of priest, so to speak. But my feeling of like of how I was personally called had nothing to do with because I thought there were a lot of really great exemplary priests. In fact, in some ways it was almost the opposite. It was always like, you know, I feel like I'm being called to do something different in the priesthood or somehow do this somehow differently than what I see. So I think that's something to think about too. It's like, if we are just doing things because we are modeling ourselves over someone else's vocation, then really the key thing is like maybe we're not really listening close enough to our own inner voice, so to speak, as to how we are supposed to be living our vocations. I always say it's very difficult to live someone else's vocation. And in the priesthood, it's the perfect example because there's lots of priests who will be like, well, I got to be like that other priest over there because that other priest is praying all the time and doing all this and whatever the thing is, whatever the criteria is. So it's like, how do you listen to your inner voice, so to speak, and how you can hear that your inner voice resonates legitimately with when people are saying certain things rather than just somehow thinking that I need to listen to what this other person is doing and do exactly what they're doing. You know, that it's all the process of the sermon in some ways too.
Sure.
John, you've mentioned both kind of modes of doing this type of listening. One is, you know, listening to what you called your inner voice, you know, doing that discernment, which we might call contemplation before action, right? And trying to understand like, what is it I'm being called to do before I actually go and do it. And I heard that same exact idea when you were talking about when homilies really connect with the congregation, right? When you seem to have listened, even if it wasn't specifically to a person or even intent, like, I don't want to say unintentionally, but you know what I mean? Like you weren't setting out to do, let's go do some listening now and then I'll be able to, you know. But is there any difference? Is there really any difference between listening to the inner voice and listening to the needs of those around you? You know, what is like, is contemplation at its most deepest or fundamental level the same thing?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I think everyone is hearing the same thing being spoken to them, and that thing is to know that they are loved and be loved. So they're hearing that somehow. But then the question is like, how am I to respond to that call placed in my heart of how I am loved by God? Like what is my response now to this gift that has been given? And that's where I think things get a little bit very unique for each person. I think that's one thing I would say. I also would say that really when we're listening to ourselves, we're probably more so listening to our longings, our desires, the things that we wish weren't the case, let's just say, in our life, or listening to this really what we wish we could be doing. And I think that that's a very common longing and a common thing that people, when they go inside themselves, so to speak, have. Like they're always thinking like what's maybe not the way they wish it could be. So I think that is a unifier. across the board. So like the I think the Buddhists will have the practice of like just like me this person wants to be happy, just like me this person wants to has been hurt, just like me this person is suffering. And like if you're just kind of being able to understand your own place where you are in your anxieties and concerns and letdowns, it makes you instantly more understanding of someone else, even though you don't know the particulars. But this is really Josh's time to be talking, so thank you for giving me it for a bit.
Well, we don't know anything about that. I mean, this is such so interesting for me to hear you talk that way. As sociologists, you know, we focus a lot on the structure. I mean, when we talk about, you know, we mean something very specific when we write about capital S, capital L, capital T, sacred listening theory, and the tools that we make, which you can get for free on our website. I'm not, you know, they're all available, is that we're really thinking through like what kinds of listening structures are needed to be able to do this at scale. As we already talked about, it's, you can't do listening based ministry by having 500 cups of coffee a week, but you need some way to sift through that to know which five. Although, John, I'll say your quote there, or your comment there reminded me of this Mother Teresa quote when I think it was Dan Rather or somebody said, you know, what do you say when you pray to God? And she said, not much. I mostly listen. And he said, well, what does God say back? And she said, well, he listens. And then she said, and if you don't understand that, I can't explain it to you. I think that is a critical component of like what we're doing for each other in this structural sociological way is like almost impossible to know how to do well by reading books. You know, it can help, especially on the cultural competency side around like, you know, what do different, you know, what are some of the behaviors that signify good listening are not universal. You know, eye contact, for example, is not, you know, is not even universal across this country. But I think at a deeper level, to understand what we mean when we say listening is sacred, I don't think you can do that if you do not feel like you have a God who has listened to you and that you've also listened to. So I think those two things are hand in hand.
One of the things that you said last season when we interviewed you, and you're the only person to have made this type of comment where you said something.
Oh, dear. That's either really good or really bad.
It's good. I'm not throwing you under the bus here. But you were the only person who said something about, you know, made a difference between Protestants and Catholics. And that's when I knew I wanted to have you back for this season, because you're able to speak intelligently and from an informed place about the differences between our denominations. You said, I like to say if Protestants would understand the Catholic concept of accompaniment, things would be so much better. If Catholics would actually do accompaniment, things would be so much better. Yeah. Can you unpack that for us a little bit?
That's great.
Yeah, I say this a lot. I was just I had the opportunity in the fall to go on a little mini tour of the state of Kansas for the Archdiocese of Kansas City. And we ended up at three stops in the greatest places. I mean, it was just like the folding tables and old basketball gyms with 20 people from the community of 50 who showed up. I mean, just like the best, right? And ended up saying it. I've said it a lot before that, but really over that, it became a point of discussion because they wanted to know the same thing. Like, what do you mean by that? And I think like in the Protestant world, they really don't. There are terms like discipleship that get somewhat close to this, but it's not the same as this, as especially the way Pope Francis is thinking about accompaniment, which is like, and the way Francis, like, you know, put this, I really liked and resonated with so much. He's like, we're not just hanging out here. Like, we're going to a destination. But the thing that sort of makes it so radical in the context of modern life is that we're going to remove the time container. You know, we're not going to, unlike lots of other things about formation, like being catechized, for example, like there is no expiration date on accompaniment. We'll be here as long as it takes. But at the same time, like there's a destination in mind. Like we're moving towards a thing. It strikes me as this really nice mixture of the ancient and the modern. I mean, this is a place we're trying to get. And also the most defining feature of the modern world, which is that everything has to be on a clock, is sort of removed. And I think that really matches the experiences of young people in particular, which these newer generations are so diverse that trying to cram them into one box bound by time is an exercise of futility. I mean, you're not likely to make the same gains that maybe you once did when culture was more homogenous and you could expect that nobody had football games on, you know, Wednesday nights and nobody had soccer practice on Thursdays or Sunday mornings or what have you. So Catholics, I think, get this. Like, it's embedded in this, the notion of what it means to be Catholic is this concept of accompaniment, but they don't always, in practice, it seems like they give back over, I would argue, too much sometimes to this, these vestiges of modern organizational life, which is that we need to have a person who's in charge of a program disseminating a message in this container. And Pope Francis was very clear, like, that's not what this means. And if we're really going to do accompaniment, which he was arguing that we should, it's here for the long haul. So, you know, that's really what I meant by, you know, trying to come up with some like way of giving footholds on both sides.
Yeah. Are you saying that like the hierarchical nature of the Catholic Church is at issue here, or the like almost just too structured approach of like trying to assign people to things is at issue here? Like, let's go a little deeper into that, because I realize as I'm saying this, I am showing up this season totally defenseless. I really just want to hear it.
I think what you're asking me to do, Dave, is just to call out the USCCB and put them on blast for it. No.
Okay. Well.
All right. Okay. Let's there not we
get
go.
Me fired here.
No. So I think this is where this is where my sociological training would come in. I would say that this is not the fault of a particular Catholic hierarchy, and certainly not of any one group or form of leadership, but rather that on balance, where we're trying to, you know, the modern world does shape us. And also as a church and a believing people, we are committed to a set of principles. Those two things are always present. I think maybe right now we've just given a little too much weight to the modern world that forces us into these, you know, organizational containers that says like a semester happens, you know, between this month and this month, and then it starts again on these months. And, you know, religious formation happens through, in my case, in the Lutheran Church, confirmation. And that happens between seventh grade and ninth grade. And, you know, like, it, you go on Wednesday nights for an hour each or whatever it is, like,
right,
that's good. You need structure, right? Like, we need some way of understanding where we're at and where we're headed and that kind of stuff. But I think we've maybe lost too much of this. And here's what I mean. Like, we don't have good organizational structures for paying professional adults who are well-trained to basically do relational ministry through accompaniment with young people, especially through their transitions, middle school to high school to college, or whatever comes next. We just don't. There's not a church in the world that does that very well. That, I mean, there are individual congregations that do it well, but there's not a system for doing it well. We sort of lost track of the major milestones that happen between the sacraments, between confirmation and marriage. There's just this wide gulf, for example, of marking time that the church has sort of let go of. And so that's what I mean. Like, I think we could ease back over a little bit of that emphasis from just sort of shuttling people through on the factory line to get them to the, you know, this end result of being catechized or having the sacrament, and remember a little bit that teenagers especially are, you know, they're here today, they're one thing, and they're here tomorrow, and they're another thing, and they're likely to change their minds. And so they need consistency through relationships in ways that content can't do alone.
So how do you envision that, like, say, in a parish community? I work with certain parishes for things, but most of my day to day is always happening in a high school community.
Yeah.
And for example, one of the things that I'm a big part of is sacramental preparation for our students. And it's always a little kind of dicey because, well, the students technically are supposed to be in parishes and they're supposed to be walking with people in their home parish, but the students don't go to parishes. So this is like, yep, this is an exception to the normative way that it's been done, which I'm like all about. Like, why do we need to kind of think like the parishes have the monopoly on, say, sacramental preparation? I don't see why that has to be that way, because even if you think you're going to have these students being part of your community while they're in high school, once they're in college, I mean, they're on their own, and they may even move further away after that. So like where this formation happens has to happen, I would say, in some type of meaningful way for them, which is meaningful in as much as they are cultivating relationships in the process. But like, is that, I don't really know really what I'm where I want to kind of ask, what type of question I want to ask here, but is it possible to have meaningful relationships that are sustainable in structures where you're in a certain sense feel like you're just checking boxes? So like, how do we do this? Because it is clearly something that is always getting in the way of how to get things quote unquote done, because there's canon law and there's all this other kind of stuff going on where you have to, everyone's trying to like juggle. But like, is there a meaningful, practical way to do this where, you know, we're cultivating genuine listening relationships inside structures which all of us have to somehow touch with, you know?
I think that there are. So, and in fact, they're sort of already happening. So if it's okay, I'm going to give a little bit of a longer answer here. When I went to campus ministry, when I went to Texas Lutheran University, I became a campus ministry assistant, became close with our campus pastor there. He and I are still in touch. He officiated my wedding. He baptized my kid. Like, I've known him now for 20 some years. Oh, no, more than that, I guess. A long time. But that is not his job. Like, you know, he was paid and he has a family and, you know, other obligations and all this sort of stuff, right? I was there for 4 years. Like, I was his job essentially for 4 years. Every time that I took from him after that was uncompensated. And I'm fully aware of that. I would hope that it became a real relationship that was reciprocated both ways, and that Greg would feel like I'm also providing something to him or fulfilling, you know, helping him to fulfill some calling that he has in his life or whatever. So, but I think I use that to illustrate that, like, and even in my wife works at a parachurch ministry here, and, you know, they kids age out at 18, but they're still having coffee with kids into their 19, 20, you know, 25 years old. They're officiating those weddings, and but they don't get any credit, quote unquote, for that. And so I think part of that starts with recognizing, like, what are we actually compensating people to do? Are we compensating them to check a box and to move people along a conveyor belt? Or are we compensating them to be formators? And what percentage of a job then is given over to lifelong formation? And if you're running a campus ministry and you don't get some part of your job, 5, 10%, I don't know what the right number is, but some part of it is not for keeping up with alumni, I would say that's nuts, right? Like, that's, and at worst, I would say maybe that's actually kind of disingenuous. It treats young people like products instead of treating them, you know, like the fully fledged contributors to the body of Christ that they are, even if they are always changing. So I think it starts a little bit with that recognition that is already happening. And then thinking through, like, okay, so with that in mind, how do we begin to measure impact differently? How do we craft these jobs differently? And how do we pass them along? So here's what I mean by the longer answer. I'll give you an example of an organization out of Texas called Every Student Sent, and they're not Catholic. But Every Student Sent's mission is to make sure that every student who goes to college is being connected in the first week with somebody else who is a believer on campus, right? So that means that there is a natural way, or I mean, in this case, there's an organization that's helping local, like, high school based youth ministries give this like direct transition over to college, because they know how important peers are when you move to college, including roommates. And so they built this whole system for how to do that. Nobody should be able to do that better. Nobody should be able to do that better than Catholics, right? There's such a, I wouldn't say it's certainly not the same level of power that it was like when my dad was going to high school. But still there's a fairly like robust system of Catholic education from K all the way through college. And a lot of those kids do persist in the same systems. There's no reason that we shouldn't be handing kids directly from the parish to my friend Rosie, who runs CCMA, to connect them with a local campus ministry at whatever church or whatever college they go to, Catholic or not. That seems like a no-brainer to me. But, you know, if it's not a part of your job and it's not a part of what you're compensating, it's not a part of the metrics that you're being tracked on when you have to write your reports or talk to your boss, it's real hard to devote time to it. So I think that stuff exists and I think we can do it. It just requires a little bit of a shift in our thinking about what we're doing, you know, what we're supposed to be doing in that space.
One thing that's been making me nervous as you speak, I of course I'm a fan of specialization and becoming a really, you know, an expert professional in whatever it is that you do. And so why should relational ministry be any different than that? The church deserves great ministry. And often we have to pay for greatness, you know, okay, that I can accept that. At the same time, aren't we talking about everyone accompanying everyone? You know, we're like, this is not just a paid job. This is a this is something that, you know, people of faith, or maybe just anyone should be seeking to do for others, right? Like, we want to be walking with one another through this thing called life. And so is there a danger in when we identify the specialists who are who are paying maybe more than we even are right now to do this well, are we getting even deeper into like the one of the issues in Catholicism, and I think this is true in probably in Lutheran churches and other especially the more established denominations, is just this kind of pay to pray sort of mentality.
Yeah.
I don't know what to call it exactly, but when people show up expecting that, well, I tithe, so I expect services, or maybe I don't even tithe.
Yeah.
This is just a free thing that I get, and it's I'm not really in the community because this is it becomes transactional. What am I in it to get? Like, you hear this when people say something like, I didn't get much out of church today, or something like that. It's like, it's a very transactional sort of mindset.
Yeah.
And so I just, is there a danger in getting even deeper into that mess as we try to focus on the people who are trained to do relational ministry rather than talking about everyone needing to do accompaniment?
Well, let's talk about what that means, to be trained to do relational ministry. And we were commissioned last year by the 10x10, what do they call themselves, a movement or a network or something. This is an effort to reach 10 million young people over the next 10 years. And so we led a research effort to unpack the sort of history, the intellectual history around relational ministry. You can go and download the white paper on our website if you're that kind of super nerd and you want to read a white paper about relational ministry.
You've plugged the website twice. You got to drop the URL.
Oh, sorry, sorry, sorry. It's futureoffaith.org. that one is futureoffaith.org/relational-discipleship. And it was, it was really interesting to me to see how many permutations this has taken. I think you're right, Dave. Like, youth ministry in particular has been, I think, in some ways victim to this over-professionalization. And what, on the one hand, we get people who are more skilled and well-trained, but on the other hand, then we compartmentalize it and we think like, oh, that's their job, right? Like, we don't do that anymore. We've outsourced this thing to those people. But I am not imaginative enough to be able to figure out a way to do viable relational ministry that way, by outsourcing it. So when we talk about doing relational ministry, well, what we mean is somebody who can build and run and pay attention to a system that involves lots and lots and lots of people. The trick on that is, of course, like, I'll use my own self as an example. At my church, when they asked me, we were down a youth minister, do you want to come and hang out with the kids every Wednesday night until forever? I was like, no. I like youth ministry. I have my own 15-year-old who I love. I like doing this work, but I can't commit to every Wednesday night, because you know how church work is. Like, there's no end to that, right? But if they were to ask me, like, hey, we have 3 students graduating this year who don't know what they want to be what they want to major in when they go to college, and you used to be a professor advising students, they're first gen, you were a first gen college student, would you mind just sitting down with them and walking them? I would, Dave, I would do that every time they asked, right? But in order to do that, in order to make that ask of me, you have to intimately know those kids.
And I think your skills.
Skills. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's exactly right. And you have to have some level of trust that the Holy Spirit will work. I mean, we're not going to expose kids to potentially dangerous and unmonitored situations. That's not what I'm saying, but mm-hmm. we got to loosen up a little bit on the idea that I might not express exactly what church teaching is on at every moment of my life. Right. And keep those things where the religious professional should be, in classes and things like that. But the relationship stuff with a trusted adult, we can broaden those out if we have that information. So when we talk about doing relational ministry as a person or as a job or role or what have you, what we mean is people who can build systems that get that kind of information and get it out to the right people. That's what our sacred listening tools are designed for. But that's something, I mean, there are other ways of doing this. It's just that we don't, when we ask people, so, you know, this is stunning. I mean, y'all are you know, probably at the same point in your lives as I am, which is, you know, it's hard to remember details about anything, even stuff I deeply care about. I have to take notes on and write down, and, you know, otherwise it's just gone. And when we ask ministers what they use, like, what's the tool you use primarily to help you keep track of what's going on with the people in your care, they would tell us that it's the Notes app on their iPhone. And like, that's not a very good system, right? Like, I forget that I've even taken a note, let alone to be able to refer back to it in 3 months. And so at a very concrete level, what does that mean? Well, it means that if somebody tells you that their grandmother is dying, do you have a system in place that ensures that a year from now you're following up with them to find out how they're doing on the 1 year anniversary of their grandmother dying? And most people don't. And it, like, so when we talk about a professional, what I mean is somebody who has that. It doesn't mean that they're always the one reaching out. Like, maybe you don't handle death very well, but you can connect them to somebody who does. But somebody has to hold that information. I don't think it requires like a special skill set. It just requires a mindset.
Mm-hmm. Some intention behind organization.
Right. Right. A set of tools.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like in our day and age, it would be so easy to kind of have those types of things in place to help us be able to more, you know, more intentionally check in with people. Like, I'm always amazed that we talk so much about efficiency and so many different ways to be organized and be able to understand where people are, just, you know, like almost like CRM fashion. And then it just kind of all is not used in any type of meaningful way, though.
Because there's no money in checking in on someone after their grandma died.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah. Well, and there's also so this is where we get into some of the differences, you know, where theology matters is that, you know, if you're in a highly evangelical context, you know, think of like non-denominational, highly evangelical churches, you feel like you're called, and many of these people are like, oh, look, I'm called to save souls. You know, like I'm trying to get people born again. What happens after that is not up to me. That's up to the Holy Spirit. It's like, in other words, like the system of long-term relational care and discipleship and accompaniment is not really in their purview.
Right.
And so sometimes I think theology can get in the way of that. Well, go ahead.
No, I think it's, yeah, exactly. And I think that Dave has a good point here too. I mean, there is no money in that. There is something to say about getting someone like on fire with Jesus, and now they're going to be a participating member of your church, and they're going to contribute to the collection each week. I mean, like, there's something that's tangible about that transaction there. But like you said, I mean, like, maybe the whole thing that we need to kind of shift the whole thing to is like, maybe we should just be completely uninterested if a person is going to become, say, a Christian or a Catholic, and we're just more concerned about how do we see the very presence of Christ already in that person. And that's enough for the exchange, if you want to call it that. That's enough for the encounter. Like, I want to somehow be able to be present to Christ already in this person, whether they call it, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's just like, if faith is a real thing, and if we who say are Christian have had some type of encounter with Christ in our life, well, then that gives us an ability to now see Christ in other people. Why can't we just be okay with that as being the end part of the encounter, rather than be like, oh yeah, but you don't have this, you don't have that, and you got to get over here, and this is like going to be even better for you. Like, why is that always part of the agenda? Like, so many people are always like, don't you want everyone to be Catholic? I'm like, no, I really don't. It's not like, if God wants that somehow, if that's the plan, I have not really been completely convinced that is the plan necessarily, because I've just been so enamored by how Christ works in all different types of places with all different types of people from all different types of, say, intellectual and religious containers that they've grown in. And I'm like, it's all Jesus at the end of the day, let's put it that way. And that's not being like some type of relativist. That's not what I'm saying at all. Yeah. It's just like, there is something to say about being universal, which is Catholic, that allows things to be as they are without you feeling like, well, it's just subpar because this person isn't like a card carrying Catholic or whatever. Like, there has to be something like that.
I love so much about what you're saying, but let me also add in it, which is always a weird place for me as a sociologist to be often on stage reminding an audience full of ministers that the Holy Spirit does in fact exist and is in charge of lots of things that you are not necessarily responsible for. Like it, your point about wanting or not wanting everybody to be Catholic is sort of, I think, this whole thing of like, I don't want or not want. I want to do what I'm called to do. And the Holy Spirit takes over from there. And it's this humility and recognizing that even if you wanted everybody to be Catholic, that is not ours to do. I mean, God's been pretty clear about this. Like at some point, what we do stops and what he does takes over. And I think that that is in some ways very, very freeing.
Absolutely.
One of my favorite reflective questions came to me from somebody who's mentoring and doing spiritual guidance for a lot of ministers, a lot of youth ministers in particular, but not exclusively, and said, you know, when I feel people slipping into this territory where they think that that person's soul is their responsibility and not God's, I tend to ask them, after they've come back from an encounter, I tend to ask them, what did God want you to see in that moment? Because it disrupts their thinking, because all they're thinking about is, you know, how did God, you know, what is God trying to turn in this person's heart? How is, you know, what did you say to them to get them to see something new? And now that he was like, it flips the script and it recognizes that they were enough for you to encounter and God put in your way. Like, did you get anything out of it? Did you see God? And I just think it speaks right to your point, John, about like that is enough.
Are there pockets of the Catholic Church that you feel like are particularly would benefit from doing more of that? You know, I want to open up your potential criticisms and feedback into beyond just, you know, we've talked at length about accompaniment, but there's so many other aspects to it, right?
There's I thought you were going to ask me who's doing it well, and I was going to say campus.
You can answer that too.
I was going to say campus ministries. I think there's really something interesting going on, especially at the college level of campus ministry. So I'll just note that because
Sure.
there's some really compelling things happening there.
Within the Catholic Church, or just across the board, you mean?
Yeah, I think it's a setting that lends itself across denominations and traditions to some of the most, you know, it's like sits right at this I can't remember who the person was who said it. It's like sort of on the edge of inside. Like there's a lot of freedom on college campuses for campus ministers to do things, and also you're enough in the structure that you have a real thing. So you can try
Richard
some of these kind
Rohr
of
is kind of famous
that.
for
Thank
talking
you,
about
thank
the,
you,
yeah,
thank
the
you.
edge of the
Yes, Richard
inside.
Rohr. Somebody once said that Future of Faith reminded them as an organization that was on the edge of inside. And I took it as just the highest compliment that I could
Yeah,
think of.
good for you.
But I think one of the like it, I mentioned earlier in this young adult space where I know that the USCCB and other places are trying to do some really interesting things and have paid attention to lately is a place where like this is a generation that is starving for, you know, connection. And where I like working remotely, I totally get why an entry-level worker wouldn't. And these are young people in many cases came out of college in a COVID era and have known nothing other than working. And, you know, they're just not plugged in, not just to a Catholic community, they're not plugged into community. So leaning more into relational approaches to engage 20 somethings feels just like obvious territory for me. But I will note one other place too, which is in the digital missionary field. And it's a there's some tremendous things going on in the Catholic digital space. And you know, those people are doing some really incredible work that end up being the most, I would say, for the people engaged there, they end up being the single point of connection that takes them through all these life transitions, maybe from college to a new city to start a job to another place when they're married. You know, they're still watching, you know what's the constant? They're still watching the same YouTube channel. They're still listening to the same podcast. They're still in the same Discord chats. And there's real opportunity there.
So you flipped my request for feedback into a compliment session, but I really do want to
Well, no,
know.
I don't think that the Catholic Church is doing either of those things really well. I mean, I
Oh,
don't think that they're
okay.
doing ministry well. I don't think that there are
Oh, these are
individual
just opportunities. These
people.
are just like really critical
Oh, I
places.
see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that the I think that there are some people doing really incredible things in the digital missionary world, but you know, the larger church infrastructure has been sort of slow to support this, in part because I don't really know what to do with them. They want a bridge back to sacramental life, and which is understandable. And in many cases, sometimes, you know, the digital missionaries are reluctant to do that because they're like, well, the things that the people like so much about being, you know, here with this community are they're not going to find when they walk into a parish, or they're unlikely to find. And traditional missionaries had a commissioning bishop or a priest or that would send them. And who controls the internet? There's not a bishop of the internet. And
well,
so
I was just
going
to make a comment about that. You know, we've seen, Bishop Barron, for example, has done AMAs on Reddit, and I think like this, I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but I do think that there are a lot of Catholics who are reticent to do any kind of relationship building when they see themselves as an ambassador of the church, because I'm not up to snuff on stuff like Bishop Barron is or some other figure, so I can't I don't feel they get uncomfortable, and it's like, and I don't even want to talk about like evangelization or something, like it's just like just I think we have to like take the pressure off, kind of like what John was saying, right? If it's not about that, if it's not about some agenda that you have and you just want to get to know the person and see what God is doing in their life or whatever, just to know them, then you can stop thinking that way. And it does, and it's not about letting the experts do apologetics or something,
But this is like, I think, a very odd and narrow way of interpreting global Catholicism that maybe is just unique to the United States. I mean, if you look what's happening broadly across the world, it's there's a much greater acceptance for, well, even from official channels, totus, 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 and quentro, and quentro, and quentro, right? Like, it's encounter for all. And when you look at those channels of what's going on, boy, I mean, it is not people who sometimes for better and sometimes for worse, who do not feel like they have to be experts in anything. They're simply offering a personal interpretation and experience with Catholicism and inviting people to join them on that journey. And that's fascinating.
You know, you're making me feel like, maybe what we often kind of derogatively call cultural Catholicism is maybe not such a bad thing, because maybe those people are doing community really, really well, and not everybody's an expert in, the theology or whatever. And that's also not the point, right? Like that is not what religion is for, and it's not what humanity is for.
Well, it's certainly not what their ministry is for. I mean, I'm not going to weigh in on like what religion is for in this case. I think it can be for a lot of things, but the way the church needs all kinds, right? Like it's so easy to not be Christian, right? So if you're gonna involve people in this story that we all think matters so much, let's take any help we can get. And right now it feels like we're closing a lot of doors and sort of trying to force people. It's like, it's like trying to force people to watch movies by going to Blockbuster and getting them, on a DVD in 2025. It's just, what are we doing?
Don't even get me started, man. I truly miss the DVD rental service from Netflix. Netflix's disc option was still going strong until I think maybe like 2023, maybe 24. Like it just shut down kind of recently.
Yeah, I was like, wow, they're still doing that.
It is a true bummer. I mean, nothing could compare to the selection, and also like taking the pressure off of like spending all the time on what you want to watch rather than just starting to watch it. It's like, just watch whatever you have.
Well, I think this really is fascinating, because there is something that is to say about like, cause I've used that analogy, that exact analogy before, Josh, about how we constantly are trying to sell people, the video rental store, when, that's just not where
people
are. In a streaming world, right? That seems to be what the church is always doing. Yeah. And then there's this other part of me that's like, well, maybe there is just something really beautiful of going analog that the church seems to have, that clearly
shameless
people
plug
don't
for
have.
John's Substack, going analog.
That people
is that what
don't.
It's called? That was so
yeah,
great. Yes,
it is. but like maybe there is something like that that people really want to go analog. And the church might have something there to offer. The thing I will say, though, is that I don't think that the church, in lots of ways, like let's just say your average parish, thinks of it in those terms. I don't think they think of it as being like, this is a way to kind of be more intentional in your presence with people and more intentional in recognizing the sacramentality of things. Like, I feel like that's not maybe the full reason why people would say, hey, come back to this video rental store experience here at church. Like, I don't think that's what's happening for some reason. I feel as if there's still this kind of strange way of trying to somehow convince people that it's cool, just like anything else is cool, rather than being, it's very unique, and by it being unique doesn't necessarily make it even like superior though either. Like, it can't be that either. It has to just be like, this is a singularly unique experience when you participate, let's just say, in something that's sacramental. And it's what is going to enhance and allow you to experience the rest of your world differently because of this. So it's not like segmented. I think maybe that's where I'm getting at. I'm sorry that I'm just trying to, I'm thinking out loud here. I think that the problem is like church gets segmented too much. Like, this is where really, really holy stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And like, this is where really important things happen. Sacraments are really, really, really important. And, you know, they're kind of cool. Just like, you know, going to the video rental store is cool, but that becomes the end point. And I think this is the fundamental problem. Like, I was thinking about this during our conversation here. Like, where do we really hope people land at the end of the day? Is there a landing place, or is there really just a sense that you are going to continue to evolve and individuate in your relationship with God? And that's going to be something that's going to be very unique, but your touch points with the church are always going to be your reminders of that portal of entry that can give you the freedom to explore what that looks like. So it's like always that both and type of thing. I know I'm saying a lot of different things. I don't know how coherent it is, but
I don't think you're being disparate at all, John. Like, this is, so obviously, I mean, I just wrote a book called Faithful Futures. I through Springtide and forward, like a lot of experience about young people. So I'll put this in that context where I think we trick ourselves into thinking that young people can have a destination with their faith. And we feel like we want to get them to a status or a state. And that is a false dichotomy. It's not true. Like, young people are going to continue to evolve. And once we recognize this, then I think it shifts our perspective more effectively to what you've just been describing. The question isn't, will they get the answers right? The question is, will you be there with them when they inevitably explore the questions that they're asking? And for me, that's all of it. It's like, you know, who they're going to ask these questions. And if the you know, is it going to be somebody on TikTok, you know, that they're turning to, or, you know, who may be helping them read their astrological signs? Or is it going to be you? And if we think of young people like, well, they've been catechized and like that's over and we're not interested in what's going on the internet and sacraments are the only thing, it's probably not going to be you, because you're not going to be where they're asking those questions. And that's the, like, that I think is what it's kind of what you're getting at, which is like, if we understand that this is a lifelong process and a journey, then I think we start building more bridges between these pathways of sacrament and sort of, I guess, non-sacrament experiences that are still much, very much a part of the life of the church.
I find the way Josh contextualizes ministry in the church so helpful, and I'm pretty sure he will go unchallenged as the ultimate guest on Religion to Reality, because I mentioned he was in our webinar series in season one and now season two, but I failed to mention that he was also one of our bonus episodes where we launched and released the entire conversation from season one with Josh. So if you missed that, definitely go back and check it out. It's very good. But yeah, let's acknowledge this is a podcast. You'll have to excuse us as we continue to try to espouse the virtues of listening through this medium that doesn't allow for a response from you, our listeners. But there is a fix for that. As I mentioned last time, and I will continue to mention, we now have a Substack, religiontoreality.substack.com, or you can just search for Religion to Reality on Substack. And that is where you can find where we're going to be doing these monthly community gatherings, these interfaith gatherings, where we're inviting people from all faith traditions
to come and be at peace with one another and share in a little bit of community. We'll do a little bit of meditation, do a little bit of sharing on a particular topic for that session. Just once a month, just for an hour online. It's totally free. And you can sign up at the Substack. So once again, religiontoreality.substack.com. And of course, stay tuned for our next episode where we'll speak with Frederica Matthews Green to hear what a member of the Orthodox Church can teach us about listening in an ecumenical way. Religion to Reality was created and executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Strapoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.